chatting about like various things.
We're going to get started in about a minute, so if people can start making their way back in and taking their seats.
I've tried not to put too much pressure on you.
You know what? I'm going to take your Derek comment.
All right. I'm just going to... we're going to kick this off. So we are very excited today to have a member panel specific on risk management. And we have some members here from JP Morgan and Wells Fargo, but Marcus is going to be introducing them. So again, we're really excited about this. Marcus?
Hello? Is this on?
Yep. I think it is?
Okay, there we go. Hi, everyone. I'm Marcus Michelson. I'm a senior manager at NFA. I've been in NFA for about just over 10 years now, and I'm very excited to be hosting this panel with our members from JP Morgan and Wells Fargo. Today with us, we have Krista Santaros, Executive Director in Swap Dealer Compliance. I'm sorry, Executive Director in Swap Dealer CCO at JP Morgan. Steve Montgomery is the Managing Director and responsible for Swap Dealer and FCM compliance at Wells Fargo, as well as Matt Miller, who's a managing director in the corporate marketing risk group at Wells Fargo. So I'm going to turn it over to them to give a brief introduction to themselves, and then we're going to walk through the the panel.
Hi, I'm Krista Santoro, and I am the Swap Dealer CCO and the head of the Swap Dealer compliance team at JP Morgan, as well as heading up teams that cover the currencies and emerging markets business, electronic trading, and digital markets areas. So I have a little bit of a crossover between the LOB experience and the kind of programmatic swap dealer experience.
I'm Matt Miller. As Marcus indicated, I'm a managing director in corporate market risk, and I focus specifically on the equity business at Wells Fargo.
Hi, I'm Steve Montgomery. I cover a couple different things at Wells, but I do some of our programmatic compliance, like our swap dealer, our FCM, and our security-based swap dealer. And then I also have line of business coverage for items or for lines of business, like our FX and rates lines of business.
Thanks, everyone. So for this panel today, we're going to be talking about risk management. Risk management is a topic that's become increasingly important over time, especially in the current market environment. And what we thought would be beneficial to is to go through with our members some of the core principles guiding the risk management at their firms, how they've implemented 23600, as well as some other areas relating to the intersection between risk and compliance. So to get started. The first question is for Wells Fargo, and what are the core principles guiding the implementation of risk governance at Wells Fargo?
Thanks, and I just want to say thanks to NFA for hosting this. I think this is a really fantastic way to get engagement between the members and the NFA itself, so and having us up here to speak through some of our experiences is really beneficial, so appreciate the invite to come speak about this. And talking about Wells Fargo, I'll talk through a couple of different programs and a couple of different documents, but I think maybe the first part is really tone from the top and leading with a risk mindset. There's no procedure or policy or process that can instill a risk environment into a firm or into a line of business. It takes everybody, and it takes senior leaders to really talk about and express the importance of ensuring that we manage risk appropriately at the firm. And the way we've done that within Wells Fargo specifically relates to the risk management framework, which is the document that we've set forth that establishes the core principles for risk management on the stagecoach. And a couple of those core principles are the fact that risk is really a part of the business model. You know, as a compliance officer, and as I assume most of the folks out here today, you know, our job and our goal is to have no risk, but that's obviously not a realistic outcome. There's always risk in everything that we do, whether it's compliance risk, market risk, operational risks, or any of the other enumerated risks out there. So an understanding and appreciation that that's just part of the business and part of the nature of the job that goes along with it. To that end, risk is managed by everyone. It's not a compliance officer's job to manage all of compliance risk for any firm. It takes everybody from the front line to independent risk management, internal audit, and really every employee to help mitigate the risks that they identify in their day-in, day-out activities and to manage that appropriately. We obviously have a risk appetite, and that talks really about the nature and level of the risk that the company is willing to take while pursuing its business activities. The risk profile of the firm, which is an assessment of the underlying risks at the, you know, within the company. And kind of a continuous feedback loop where we look at day-in, day-out events as they occur, whether those are breaches of risk limits, whether they're exams or internal audits or testing, internal analysis, new business, new products, and look to those to inform how we think about the risk program that we have in place and determine, as those real-life events are happening, how we need to modify and change the risk environment, whether that's different limits, whether that's different business practices, et cetera. And as we think about how that relates to 23600, you know, we use those kind of core principles from the risk management framework to then inform and kind of drive how we put forth the risk management program all those years ago and how we continue to maintain and enhance it today. So just looking at a couple of those core principles from a risk appetite perspective, you know, we've looked at risk tolerance limits, you know, and obviously they're enumerated by 23600, but we've instilled that within the overall risk management framework that we had. We've also looked at inner and outer boundary limits for each one of those, and I think we've had those generally since the inception of the RMP within Wells Fargo. And we use that framework to help kind of set those limits and look at what they are. From a risk profile perspective, as we look at the risk exposure report, we're not just looking at, you know, a regulatory requirement or meeting the specifics of what's required by that reg, but really looking at what's the information that's going to be useful to senior leaders, the governing body, senior management, and to the commission and to the regulators as they review that document. So it's not just a check-the-box exercise. It's not just a here's seven risk tolerance limits as it relates to market risk and here's how we did for a given quarter. It's really providing more information, how we view those risk tolerance limits, you know, if we've seen trends, if we've seen information, and that all is useful to the recipients of the report. And then lastly, I'll just say from a continuous feedback loop perspective, we obviously have our annual exam of the risk management program, again, required by regulation, and internal audit does that within Wells Fargo. But we also have periodic testing that's done, and that looks at components of the risk management program. We obviously have engagements with NFA and our other regulatory bodies. And then we have kind of presentations from our RMU leads and from the actual folks that are managing the risk day in, day out, and reporting on it appropriately, where they're giving information about how the businesses are functioning, how those risk limits are working in real life, and determining if there's changes needed or enhancements needed to the program. So it's really then the marriage of what our risk management framework is at the top of the house, but then making it specific to meet the core requirements of 23600.
Thank you, Steve, and we're looking forward to hearing more about that as we go through the more detailed questions in the panel. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that, Matt?
No, not that.
Okay. Krista, how about for J.P. Morgan? Could you talk about the core principles for risk management at J.P. Morgan?
Sure. So in many ways, it's very similar. Sorry, just kicked the table. To what Stephen mentioned, right? We have sort of a top-down tone and culture, which is very, very strong. In addition to that, we have risk assessment that happens both for quantitative risks, so I would say your credit, your market, your liquidity, et cetera, and also for your more qualitative risks, primarily those that sit within compliance or operational risk. Those frameworks feed into a central point. They are a part of our risk assessment, whether qualitative or quantitative. Obviously, the quantitative is a bit more numerical and something I think Matt could speak to a bit more. And similarly, our qualitative limits help to inform where we want to focus our testing, where we want to focus our audits, where we want to focus our issues, and a lot of that is also informed by what turns up when we're doing our diligence for the CCO report, which is close to my heart because it's due very, very soon.
Thank you, Crystal. Now, we understand that independence is a really critical aspect of risk management, and one of the things that's top of mind for us at NFA is to, you know, understand what does independent risk management mean to you and to your firm. And could you take this one, Crystal?
Absolutely. And so I would say our risk management program, which is run by a central team in risk, has three main tenets. One is documentation, making sure we have it clearly documented, roles and responsibilities and expectations are clear. The second is that we maintain independence, which I will talk about in a little bit more detail. The third is that we have good, robust escalation protocols and independent escalation. So when we think about independence, our risk management unit is independent of our first line, right? So we run a classic three lines of defense model. The first line is business controls, operations, technology. Our second line is compliance and risk. Our third line is audit. The independence of the RMU is ensured by our committee structure. Each of our swap dealers has a committee that is chaired by the respective chief risk officer of that swap dealer. That representation on the standing RMU is only second line or first line staff that are not part of the business trading unit or the clearing unit, although they may come to present matters. And the decision-making and the escalation processes are ultimately at the behest of the chief risk officer for that particular entity, and we think that that gives us a good way of ensuring the independence. I'll clear my throat a little bit. The second point I would make about independence is on a more practical level, right? Our second line staff, including compliance, and I'm a compliance officer of two decades in now, so I'm aging myself a bit, but here we go. But we are co-located, typically, particularly for the line of business staff, is how we call it at JP Morgan, on the trading floors. And then there's the separate swap dealer central teams. A lot of our risk staff are as well. So in addition to these committees, there's also this practical sort of feedback loop where people are co-located on the floor, are subject matter experts in the products and the businesses, and, you know, and in the regulations.
In terms of the, you know, the way the committees work, could you talk about what effective challenge means to you and your organization?
Sure. So again, effective challenge for purposes of the committees means that we've got independent representation, that there are people who are empowered, ultimately from the chief risk officers of the entity all the way up to the firm-wide chief risk officer who is direct report into the firm-wide CEO. So we're completely separate, compliance and risk, up until you get to that point. So that ensures that we give independence. In terms of challenge, we have seats at the table not only in our own forums, but there are first-line firms. And granted, JP Morgan is a huge firm, right? So it's not going to work for everyone. Some of you may be looking at me and saying, yeah, my firm is not, you know, 300,000 people strong, and I get it. So I will freely admit what I'm talking about is a JP Morgan thing, but also something you can think about in terms of independence. So back to that point, what effective challenge looks like is we have the escalation points in those forums. We have seats at the table in every new business process that goes through, right, both compliance and risk, as well as various other teams, so that we are providing challenge that is documented through that process and making sure that as implementation is happening, our challenges are being accounted for so that we can work as best we can to mitigate risk to the firm. And we also have we have seats at the table at the business committees. So the business has their own committees where they kind of review each of their issues. Those include compliance, risk, audit, representation. Those are monthly, typically, and escalate all the way up to the top of the house, ultimately. And so you have multiple forums for challenge available to second-line staff as well as independent reporting lines.
Thank you, Crystal. Turning to Wells Fargo, does this sound familiar?
It kind of sounded foreign to me. I'm not sure I've heard of any of those concepts. No, I think largely we're going to have a very similar process and a very similar construct within the independent risk management function of Wells Fargo. We also operate on the classic three lines of defense. We roll into our chief risk officer, who reports into to the board of the bank. So there's independence all the way throughout. Completely agree on the construct of effective challenge, and it's really a core tenet of what we do as risk officers from a market risk or from a compliance risk perspective. We have seats at the table at committees. We review, when there's issues management concerns, when there's new products, we're always involved in that process. And we also have, and I'm sure it's the same for many of you out there, we have monitoring processes that are in place so that we can challenge the business through its normal day-to-day business activities. Those monitoring routines are generally based on a risk rating rationale, so the more high or critical are going to be monitored more closely and frequently. Things that are a bit lower risk have a little bit of a less frequent monitoring perspective. But again, it's another sort of systemic process that we have to ensure that we have the insight and the transparency into what the business is doing so that we can make those effective challenges. And that's on top of all the ad hoc interactions and conversations and the co-location that we have as well, where we can see things, overhear things, just reach to somebody on the next row over and say, hey, we want to talk to you about X, Y, or Z, and have that conversation and make sure that we're comfortable with the responses.
Understood.
No, I would just say that from a market risk perspective, Christy, you talked about it being a bit more quantitative, and so it's a little bit easier on a continuous basis to be looking at that. Credible challenge will start with the limits that we're setting for the businesses and how they're dealing with that. So, we're part of that process. The escalation is very much the same, and yes, we are involved in those committees as we discussed. So, just more of kind of how we're involved. We're in continuous all the time. We're on the floor with the traders, and. So that's part of it.
And I think just to add on to that, too, I think going back to the tone of the top message, I think we, and I don't want to speak for anybody else here, but I think are going to have a very similar approach to any sort of risk limit breach, whether that's from a 23600 perspective, whether that's from a trader desk mandate perspective, that gets escalated and gets reviewed by a lot of different folks within the firm, both from a frontline and a second-line perspective. And you need to have that top-down approach to say that these are extraordinarily serious, that we have these limits in for a reason. There can certainly be rationales for why a limit was breached, the system wasn't working as quickly as we needed it to, there was an approved increase that just hadn't been reflected. But any time that light turns red, like it has to be reviewed and it has to be at the top of the house exposure. Again, that's mandated and dictated by senior leadership within the firm.
Agree. And I think one thing I would add to that is consequence, right? That if that is escalated, and if someone is breaching the limits or doesn't have the right reasons for it, then there is, there is consequence for it. And I think otherwise, it limits the teeth sort of the program.
100% agree.
Thank you. Turning now from the firm's, enterprise risk management frameworks and looking more specifically at, Regulation 23600, Matt and Steve, could you speak to how you integrated governance for the 23600 regulation into your enterprise risk management frameworks?
So I'll start maybe a little bit with just how we've approached 23600, and then Matt, I can turn it over to you to give a little more day in, day out specifics.
Yeah.
So from a governing body perspective, we use a committee of the board to comprise our governing body. We do look for kind of a diverse set of job responsibilities or job roles so that we don't just have the same sort of three types of people doing the same thing. We usually have groups of three so that we always have at least a majority and we don't get split in a 50-50 scenario. So we do look for folks that potentially are in the first line from a control perspective or that are high enough in senior leadership that they're not part of the business training unit, obviously feel very importantly about keeping the independence of the RMU from the BTU, but also have, similar to Krista, we have our chief risk officer involved in the governing body as well, and they're there to help really provide direction and make sure that the way that the program operates meets enterprise requirements. From a underlying perspective, we identify for each of our risk stripes that are contained within the RMU or within the RMP. We identify RMU leads, so we've identified sort of one person that speaks to that risk stripe, whether it's market risk or credit risk or liquidity or so on and so forth. That's not to say that that's the one person that does all the work or is solely responsible for ensuring compliance with 23600 or with the risk tolerance limits, but they're a central point of contact, so they or their team can help sort of identify concerns, identify breaches, escalate appropriately, and then provide subject matter expertise as it relates to the remediation of those. And then we've identified sort of senior management that are folks within their organizational chain that can help then provide the supervision and oversight of those individuals. So we think that construct sort of operates and meets, of course, the requirements of 23600, but then actually is providing effective risk management by having that group of individuals involved within it.
And then I suppose, you know, in terms of extending that and talking about how the enterprise's risk management framework comes into play, one of the key concepts is a risk appetite. I mean, Stephen, you mentioned that in your first remark. And, you know, when we think about the risk appetite, whether it's at the enterprise level or even at the legal entity level from a swap dealer perspective, it starts with understanding what can we do and then asking ourselves what should we do. And I think, you know, the distinction there is pretty much based on, look, we have opportunities that the firm's facing from a business strategy perspective, and that helps us service our customers. At the same time, we have to measure that against our responsibilities to our stakeholders and to the regulatory obligations we have. And so, you know, it's best understanding that. And what we're going to do is we're going to take that risk appetite as a baseline. We're going to start moving through it. We're going to look at the opportunities. Now, a lot of this starts to get into the market risk side, but it certainly hits every risk stripe. You know, where are we looking to grow? What are the new products we're talking about? What are areas where we may be looking to exit businesses if that's necessary? But all of them impact that risk appetite, and it's that touch point. And so in each of those considerations, what we're trying to do is we're trying to establish at that particular level what are the changes that are necessary. But it's always important to keep in mind where the enterprise sits. So it's part of that framework, and we understand what that is. And so it's an iterative process. You've mentioned feedback loops. That's one of the things that I would say that happens here. You look at what you're doing at the local level, decide what your business is trying to accomplish, and then you're going to set those limits, and you're going to think to yourself, okay, wait a minute, what kind of update is this going to require at the top of the house? Conversely, what's happening at the enterprise can certainly influence what's happening at the local level. And so it is that feedback loop of constantly keeping that, you know, in where it needs to be. So it can act as a constraint. It certainly informs the process. And so ultimately, going back to what I said from that distinction, we're trying to make sure that we find the right balance that gets us to what we should be doing from a risk perspective.
Thank you, Matt. Could you elaborate a little bit on this idea of what can we do? Could you maybe share some detail? What are the kind of parameters that you take into account when thinking about what you know, as opposed to what should we do, like the outer boundary?
I'll start with that one. Yeah. I mean, from a market risk perspective, we're looking at sort of the risk that's going to be introduced to the firm by what we do servicing the customers in the trading business. And those are reasonably straightforward. I mean, there are aspects that may be RTLs, that may not be RTLs, but they're going to come into what the firm's comfortable with in terms of doing. So, you know, I suppose that I would describe it as there's a capacity. And then the should is really sort of, okay, look, there are certain things from a customer perspective that we're comfortable with and other things that maybe we're less comfortable with, but that's where we'll design the limits around those activities to ensure that we only take on the business that's right for us.
Yeah, and I'll just add from a risk capacity perspective, and I think that's a key consideration there, right? If we're looking at it purely from the numbers perspective, purely quantitatively, you know, you can look at balance sheet, you can look at, you know, assets and look at, you know, a number of different factors that say, okay, the bank can do X or can do Y and has the bandwidth to do so, but is that a prudent way to actually conduct the business? We shouldn't be stretching to the very end. We need to have the guardrails. We need to have the considerations. We need to have a number of different underlying businesses that all flow into the larger Wells Fargo organization, and I think this is going to be very similar for folks out in the audience, where it's, okay, yes, the bank can do a lot, but our subsection of the bank can only do a certain percentage of that, and we all need to manage that appropriately by doing what we should do so that when it flows to the top of the house, we're still comfortably within our risk bounds and that the feedback we're getting from the top of the house is that we're managing this appropriately.
Mm-hmm. And just one last point, it is a partnership between frontline and second line. I mean, independent risk is there to help bank. Right, and to help our frontline partners to get to the right answer.
Thank you, Matt and Steve. Turning to you, Krista, could you talk about the integration of 23600 into J.P. Morgan's enterprise risk management framework?
So actually, and I can only give a very high-level answer because my risk partner is traveling and not here. But it's very similar. And I think one of the things that really resonated with what Wells was saying is what you can do versus what you should do, right? Obviously, these both of us have massive balance sheets. Like, there's a lot of capital available. However, it's really important that you maintain sort of, you set your limits so that you're maintaining the soundness, that you're taking responsible approaches to your risk, whether it's quantitative or qualitative. And then from my side, which is a little bit more of a qualitative approach to risk, that you're thinking about the sort of intangible factors. What does your reputational risk look like when this goes wrong, or if someone interprets it differently 4 years or 5 years from now? How much trouble do you get in? And stay away from that, because it's just really probably not worth it, especially for places like, you know, the news articles sort of hit fast, and then all of a sudden your reputation takes a hit, and it's not in many cases worth it. But from an enterprise perspective, yes, we obviously have robust enterprise risk management given the oversight from the banking regulators, and then we translate those same principles into the entity-specific RTLs for the relevant individual swap dealers, one of which is the bank, so obviously it's a huge operating entity.
Yes, it is.
And I was just going to add, it's really important to have those lines of communication open from both the top down and from the bottom up, because there's a sweet spot that works for everybody, right? The front line's getting its objectives met. From a compliance perspective, I'm very comfortable with how we're meeting the regulatory requirements. From a market risk perspective, Matt's happy that we're doing what we need to do and we're meeting his limits. So it's really communication and having, again, that tone from the top leadership of making sure that folks understand and appreciate the importance of all components of risk, and that we mitigate and manage that appropriately within every employee within the firm.
And then I think one thing I would add to that, which is more sort of, you know, anecdotal, I would say, for the compliance officers in the room, is sometimes you need to make sure you're going to the right level of supervisor in the business, right? So they will want to do something. I think the more senior you get, the more holistic a view they have of what the risk should look like across the organization. So being not afraid to sort of make sure it's escalated to the right level and that the supervisor agrees with what they're asking for is really critical.
I 100% agree with that sentiment. There's a lot of unique or kind of specific or surgical issues that can pop up from time to time, but that doesn't mean that the response or the remediation is specific to that individual or even to their manager. It's not about assigning blame. It's not about trying to go up and above. It's making sure that the right folks have the right level of visibility into what's actually occurring within their business, because some of these senior leaders, you know, they could have hundreds of folks within their organization, and there could be somebody three rows down that did something that they don't have an understanding or appreciation of, but that could have significant consequences from a compliance perspective, from a market risk perspective, and they can't manage their business function properly unless they have the information available at hand.
Well, that leads us nicely into the next topic, which is the partnership between risk and compliance. So turning to Krista, could you talk about what the partnership between risk and compliance looks like for JP Morgan?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, we all report into the same organization, right? It is risk management and compliance. So we work very, very closely with our risk counterparts, both at a central level for purposes of the swap dealer, and the risk management program team is, you know, closely integrated with my swap dealer compliance team. And, you know, if a day goes by where we're not talking to each other about something, that's pretty rare. So it's a pretty close relationship. Separately from that, from a compliance and risk perspective, obviously on the LOB sort of specific levels, people will work closely with their risk and compliance counterparts. There might be issues that come up around transactions where there's a credit component that needs to be addressed, or, you know, someone will ask us because they see us first, and we say, well, that's a market risk issue. You need to take it to them. So we make sure that there's kind of intercommunication and connectivity between the groups. We also, as I mentioned, are all representatives on the same committees, so that the risk perspective is represented as well as the compliance perspective. And we have this kind of additional role, right? Like, we work closely with our risk colleagues. In addition to that, we are also sort of a challenge function for them. So making sure, you know, the model governance, the reporting looks the way that it's supposed to, because obviously the swap dealer rules have a significant component of capital and risk associated with them. So we will work quite closely with them on those things. And I would say I've gotten slightly more quantitative over the last year as a result.
You want to start?
Sure. Well, I mean, we prepped for this for weeks, and we still walked over together. So I think the partnership's actually doing pretty well still. But It is all about open communication, and at its core tenet, right? Like we're risk officers, and yes, I have compliance risk. Yes, Matt has market risk, but at the end of the day, we're all risk officers. And so, trying to make sure that we have that connectivity with all of the other risk officers that work at Wells Fargo, and it's a large organization, so there's quite a few of them. But it's not being siloed to think, oh, I'm only thinking about this from a compliance perspective or a 23600 perspective. What's this actually mean for liquidity risk? Are we actually comfortable about this with from a market risk perspective? In engaging those subject matter experts, because I can't speak to what Matt does on a day in, day out basis intelligently, but I make sure that we have that connectivity and that we're comfortable that he's getting his needs met from what he's looking at, I'm getting my needs met from what I'm looking at, and we make sure that we're comfortable with overall that the risk is being mitigated.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add is it's going to be a little bit of a broken record, but it is tone at the top, as you've mentioned a couple of times. And one of our core tenets is leading with a risk mindset. I mean, you've got to kind of start there. And if I'm leading with a risk mindset, it means, yes, I'm focused on market risk because that's what I do, but I also have to say to myself, what are the other risks involved? And am I comfortable that, you know, we've done everything that's necessary? It's important for us to have that open communication. And so I am consistently looking away from, after I've evaluated the market risk, not before, but after I've looked at that, you know, what else should I be asking? Who else should I be talking to? And so that risk mindset is what we go in with, and it keeps us from just being staying in your lane.
And it can be as simple as a 5-minute phone conversation, which I know these days everything's email, everything's chat. But just picking up the phone and being like, hey, I want to just, you know, pick your brain about this for just a quick second. And it might be nothing. They might say, hey, that sounds great. I'm well aware of it. They've already informed me. Hopefully that's the answer we get, right? Maybe not always the answer we get, but hopefully the answer we get. But it can be a really quick conversation to have that and make sure that we're on the same page and that we're comfortable with the action that's being taken.
And so because this is largely a compliance audience, I would say be familiar with sort of where the boundaries are and where there are other people who have more of the expertise. Because I do think, I don't know if this is everyone's experience, but I've spent a lot of my career sitting on trading floors now, and a lot of it is, oh, compliance is everything. Compliance is HR. Compliance is risk. Because they see us. And so being aware and building up those relationships to make sure that, you know, the risk management is happening the way it's meant to is really critical.
And that's kind of like the curse and the gift of being a compliance officer, right? There's an expectation that you can do everything. But at the same time, that exists because you do end up having those connections with all these different groups, where I feel that other individuals within a firm might be a little more siloed into only looking at X or Y, where with the compliance, we have to make sure that we're comfortable with capital. We have to make sure we're comfortable with liquidity. We have to make sure we're comfortable with electronic trading platforms. So you do get exposure to everybody, and you do build those connections, and it makes it easier when you're trying to either identify risk, identify root causes, or determine remediation efforts.
One of the themes that seems to be emerging through the panel discussion is effective communication. I mean, that's what I keep hearing, you know, is that we've got open lines of communication and that there's effective communication between the various stakeholders. And you both spoke about the committees and making sure that there's representation on your committees across the, you know, the various dimensions of the firm that have a stake in any kind of business activity that's being discussed tonight. So I just wanted to highlight that. But as we are running low on time here, we're going to turn the page here, and we're going to change the topic a little bit and talk about the relationship between our member firms and NFA and what makes for productive dialogue with NFA during the exam process and even outside of it. Hand this to Crystal.
Sure. So I find that the NFA exams are actually valuable. Time-consuming, but valuable. And the reason that they are very valuable is because it gives us a sense of maybe what you guys are seeing, what you're expecting, that we're not thinking about, right? And you see that because you've got a horizontal view across multiple firms. So in that way, the exam process, the communication, seeing what the questions look like, helps us think about, okay, are there things that we're not considering? Are there things that maybe we're not aware of that other firms are dealing with that we should be thinking about differently? And that, I think, adds a lot of value to how we think about the program and making sure that it works as a whole. The second thing I would say is that it's really important to, from my perspective, have open dialogue with our NFA contacts, and I see many of them in the room here, because when we have questions about gray areas, things we're thinking about how to implement, what I found is the NFA is actually very open to having that conversation, to taking feedback, to responding to feedback, and so I would encourage everyone to use that as an avenue available to you. And I would say one example of that was the recent sort of industry engagement on the supervisory notice, which I, you know, is, you know, I thought was productive. And the third thing I would say is during the exam process, one thing we found is really valuable, and a shout out to my regulatory engagement colleagues, because they are excellent at managing the relationships in the exam process, is not to let it go too far down the rabbit hole. So if you've got a question and you're not sure what they're asking, or we are answering a question and the responses that come back seem like it's not really clear that we're answering the same question, ask. Have a conversation. Like, figure out what the question is rather than going through three rounds of answering the wrong question and, again, everyone getting increasingly frustrated by it. Because I have, again, found in our exam processes that the examiners have been very open to that.
And we certainly encourage that, especially around the document requests, especially around even meeting requests and any kind of inquiry. It's best to, you know, really get on the same page about what the ask is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think people come in with a lot of assumptions about what the questions are.
Mm. Yeah. No, I mean, and I agree kind of, Krista, with everything that you just described. I'll just say that it's nice to have the engagements with NFA and the exams, and to have that different perspective on how they're looking at the rules are being met. I think at the end of the day, right, we're all trying to do the right thing. We're all trying to have an effective risk management program. Like, that's the core tenet of why we do the jobs that we do. But at the same time, we don't know everything as much as I try to tell the business that I do. And, you know, you do get siloed a little bit on, you know, I'm thinking about it from my perspective. You know, Matt's thinking about it from his perspective. NFA has their own different, unique perspective that they come on. And I know Marcus specifically, we've talked on our engagements. And just getting a sense of what you're looking at, what you're seeing, opens our eyes a little bit as far as, are there things that we could do better? Are there ways that we could describe the risks that we're trying to mitigate a little bit differently? Could we increase the number of risk tolerance limits that we have to make it more meaningful and be more, you know, more impactful to the firm, to the senior management, to the regulators? And so I think having that engagement and that dialogue is 100% really useful, and I encourage everybody to take advantage of it. And on the last point, I'd also say, as part of the engagement process, shout out to my reg relations team who's in the audience, that having that open level of dialogue and making sure that there's an understanding and appreciation of what the ask actually is and what the information that's being delivered is really important. And again, having a quick conversation, whether that's a weekly pull-up and touch point to have a conversation, whether it's a, hey, we're going to send you this response, but a five-minute call might be helpful to at least frame or inform you of what you're getting so that there's not going down the rabbit hole, there's not a presumption. And I think that works both ways. So having that level of dialogue and engagement, I think, can really help the engagement, the exam process, and really helps foster a positive experience.
Thank you, Steve. It looks like we are close on the time here, but I did want to leave some time for questions in case we have any from the audience.
Hi, thank you. So before, I apologize, I forget your name. When you were talking about effective challenge, you meant in terms of maintaining the documentation, the frameworks, and, you know, where you may note some of this stuff. Is that maintained by the business lines, or is it maintained by the second line? And if so, would you say it's more of an ops risk group that kind of handles that? Or if you were to break up the silo of who maintains that, where would you describe that to live?
So I think it will vary firm by firm. For us, a lot of the maintenance of the risks and the challenges to those risks rest with the first line. Our job is to challenge it and provide the feedback, which is documented, but primarily in systems owned by the first line. There is a lot of the risk assessment that is the purview of operational risk as well. And there, so our technical compliance organization, well, I say compliance because I'm a compliance person, is CCOR, which is compliance conduct and operational risk. And we're kind of that main stripe under the risk organization as well from a compliance conduct and operational risk perspective. So there will be different operational risks and there will be compliance risks that are being assessed, but primarily the responsibility for maintaining the documentation is with the first line, although obviously, like, the content of our challenges is our responsibility. And I'm Krista.
Thank you, Krista.
Thank you all for your time. So there's a flavor in 23600 about ongoing monitoring and reporting of the violations. I'll also encourage employees to speak up. So I guess my question has two flavors. One is, what's your expectation and your best practice over reporting the or detecting the violations apart from just black and white breach of RTLs? And the second is the encouraging of employees to speak up or reporting the violations without feeling without the fearing of retaliation. So how do you go about that?
I can take the first stab at it if you want.
So
we have multiple ways of escalation happening, right? We've talked about the forums. We've talked about the co-location. And for people who don't feel like their second-line colleagues who sit on the floor or their supervisors are a safe way to go, we have the anonymous reporting hotline. That is, in all cases, escalation is non-retaliatory, right? Like, we have a policy of not retaliating against people who are escalating concerns or issues and investigating those issues. And one way, like I said, if you don't feel like you're getting the traction you need from the more obvious available channels to you is the anonymous reporting hotline. So we want to make sure that people do have a voice and feel like they can raise concerns, because that's important.
Yeah, and again, not to sound like a broken record for like the 12th time, but a tone from the top of being able to message that out, that folks can escalate without fear of retaliation, is really important. And through, you know, trainings, through awareness sessions, through just meetings with the business, there's always a component of, if you have a concern about anything, escalate to your manager, escalate to a different manager, escalate to your independent risk partners, escalate to somebody, escalate to the anonymous hotline. There's a number of different avenues out there, and you just want to make sure the employees have the awareness and the information of where they can go to escalate any concerns they might have.
Okay, well, it looks like we're at time and we're out of questions, so I'd just like to take a moment to thank our panelists again. I really appreciate you joining us and for the wonderful discussion.
Thank you very much for having us.
We'll now be transitioning into our last session, so I just ask for everyone's patience as we move on to the stage for that.